Bream, hello, friends. Good to be with you here this Sunday morning. We are all sleeping, aren't we? You need to stand up and shake it out a little bit? Yeah? Okay. If you need to, go ahead and stand up or stretch your arms out. I'm wondering if anybody else heard about this new book that's being released about Henry Ford. Have you heard about Henry Ford? You know who Henry Ford was? What did Henry Ford do? Right, he made it so it's more efficient to build cars, so he was like the owner of what, Chevrolet? Okay, you're listening. All right, so which company did he start? Ford Automotive. Okay, so Henry Ford has this new book coming out, and you know, there's been other books that have been written about Henry Ford. It's not really a big deal to have another book about Henry Ford come out. But this one is different because this isn't simply about Henry Ford. It was written by Henry Ford. Yes, they found some old documents that he had written, some like diaries and things like that he kept. So after all of these years, Henry Ford is going to have a book come out. It's going to be an autobiography. All right, so that is not true, but it's a joke. But we are going to be engaging in some history today. We're going to be looking at some more martyrs. Who's excited to talk about martyrs today? All right. We are all excited. Last week, I started a new sermon series. If you missed that Sunday, welcome to go back and you can check it out online. Last week, we talked about the third century martyrs, Felicity and Perpetua. They were two women who gave their lives for their faith. And all of this series is coming back to this realization I had a couple weeks ago when I started asking the question of how firm is my commitment to following Jesus Christ. We looked at different people who have had to give up relationships in this world because of their relationship to Jesus. Relationships with their parents, relationships with family members that have been divided because someone decided they were going to become a Christian. Some people have even been separated from their own, separated from their own life, separated from their own body. They have been killed for their faith. So my question was, what would I do? What am I willing to stand up for in this world? Am I willing to sacrifice a few relationships? Am I willing to sacrifice even my life? And thankfully, I don't have to make that decision today. But we look at these stories of the martyrs who did stand firm in their commitment, their conviction to follow Jesus, even when it may cost them a lot here on this earth, may even cost them their very life. So if the word martyr is a little weird for you today, remember that the word martyr simply means in Greek a witness. And we have used this term to describe people who have given their life for their faith. This is the ultimate witness to the watching world of what we believe. So we looked at these third century martyrs last week, and I think it was an interesting sermon. I say that, and I'm the one that preached it. It was interesting to me anyway. But I also realized a couple of things last week. I realized that this can be a really, strange topic. It can be really dark at times. And as I was preaching last week, I realized that I need to kind of change my format a little bit. Because I ended with the story of the martyrs, and as I looked out on the congregation, you're all just like, ah. And it's like, and go forth and do likewise. Maybe that's not the best format. We're learning as we go. So what we're going to do this week is I'm going to flip-flop it a little bit. We're going to start by telling the stories of the martyrs. Then we're going to look at the Bible story and give you some practical application. So we can send you off with a little bit more of an upbeat kind of feel to the service. And you're not all just like, oh my goodness, what are we doing? Also, I want to say that next week we are meeting at 11 o'clock at Montgomery Hall Park. And I realized that this might be a great time to bring friends. So I also thought it might be a really good time to take a break from this sermon series. Because, there won't be a live stream of that service. But I also realized that if you're bringing someone who doesn't normally come to church and their first experience in a church is the pastor talking for half an hour about people dying, by lions and tigers and bears, oh my, it might be a little awkward. So we're going to take a one-week break. And we'll come back to the martyrs in October. But today what I want to do is we're not going to follow chronology from the 3rd century to the 4th and 5th on up. What we're going to do is we're going to jump ahead and we're going to look at some 21st century martyrs. Now I realize too that this may cause some people more than just like a little anxiety. This may trigger some people because these stories are a little more real, especially I feel it a little bit more when I look at these stories of Tom and MJ, these two people we're going to discuss today, because these are people that some of us actually knew, people who lived in this area. We'll talk about Tom, who lived in Virginia, MJ, who went to Eastern Mennonite University, is actually a relative of Marlene's. So this, as I'm studying this passage for today, this topic for today, it got real for me real fast. It's way different thinking about a third century martyr dying when they're fed to the lions than it is to think about a 34-year-old man being a peacemaker in the Congo. So realizing that's going to be really heavy, we're going to try to keep it somewhat light. I'm not going to give you the details of how they died. I want to talk about how they lived. And today we're going to be looking at this idea of being a peacemaker, because both Tom and MJ, Tom Fox and Michael MJ Sharp, gave their lives in an effort to be peacemakers. And I realize that here in this church and the people watching online, not everybody's at the same place whenever we talk about war and nonviolence. But what I think we can all agree on is that these are inspiring stories of people who took the call of Jesus to be peacemakers seriously. And they did so, and it cost them their own life. So today, I hope that you will be inspired by the stories of Tom and MJ. And before we actually get to them, I think we need a little bit of background to know just what these people, why they are so inspiring to me. All right, so far, we can handle that? All right, keep breathing. It'll be heavy, but I think, again, you will be moved by the story as I have been. So the reason that I wanted to jump ahead and look at these 21st century martyrs today, people who died for their faith, being peacemakers in this world, is because I'm a part of a book study, and recently, this book study, we looked at the book Resident Aliens by Stanley Hauerwas and Will Willimon. Anybody out here ever read that book? Yeah. Curtis is in the book study, so. As I'm reading this, I came across this story, and, you know, it's been years since I read the book, and they kind of team write this book, so there's times that Hauerwas is writing, other times Willimon is writing. They're both retired professors from Duke Divinity School. Duke Divinity is a United Methodist school, and they're training up pastors and missionaries to go out in the field. So years ago, as they are in Duke Divinity, they're doing their teaching, they notice that there's some sort of disturbance among the students. And the students, it turns out, they're debating some ethical questions. See, at this time, the United States had just bombed Libya. And the bombing of Libya took place with some indiscriminate bombing. There were military personnel and there were civilians that were killed in this bombing. So the students begin debating back and forth. How ethical is it to perform a bombing whenever you're killing innocent people, innocent civilians? And they're going back and forth and back and forth. And they decide to ask one of these professors. I think they specifically are asking Will Willimon in this. And yes, Will Willimon is his real name. William Willimon. So they go to Willimon and they ask him, you know, what would you do in this situation? You know, how do you feel about this bombing in Libya? And Willimon says, you know, I can't support it. Especially because these non-combatants were targeted in the killing. And one of the students just gets upset. He's like, you would say that. Like, you're such a hippie. You know? You're such a hippie. You would say something like that. Well, what other alternative is there? There's only these two choices. They're either bomb them or just let them get away with whatever they're doing. And they said, what would be a good Christian response? You know, tensions are getting real high. People have strong convictions about this. And Will Willimon says, you know, I think the Christian response would be if the United Methodist Church were to send 1,000 missionaries to Libya tomorrow. And this student just got upset about this. He said, you know, that's not even practical. We can't do that. First of all, you can't send Americans to Libya because they won't allow Americans in. Second of all, you can't do that because, you know, you couldn't get a visa for 1,000 missionaries to go into Libya. That's not even possible. And Willimon thought about it for a little bit. He says, you know what? You're right. We can't do that. But not for the reasons that you just stated. And these are the words directly from Willimon. And sorry, I've got to break it up because I have these pictures. Willimon says this. He says, we can't go there because we no longer have a church that produces people who can do something this bold, but we once did. We can't send 1,000 missionaries to Libya in the middle of violence because the church no longer trains people to do that sort of thing. But we once did. So what happened? You know, we became complacent. We became happy just to be peacekeepers from afar. And this is the way Willimon and Hauerwas end this chapter. Again, it deserves quoting at length. They say, we would like a church that again asserts that God, not nations, rules the world, that the boundaries of God's kingdom transcends those of Caesar, and that the main political task of the church is the formation of people who see clearly the cost of discipleship and are willing to pay the price. I heard a out there. Can I get an amen? A church that asserts that God, not nations, rules the world. So I started thinking about this passage after I read it here recently, and I thought of these two individuals. I have to go back and show their picture. And apologize, our projector is starting to get washed out. The ribbon is wearing down, so if anybody wants to make a tax-deductible donation by the end of this year, please let me know. This is Tom Fox on the left, and Michael M.J. Sharp on the right. So as I thought about this passage from Willimon and Hauerwas, I thought of these two individuals who both gave their life in an effort to make peace. Tom Fox died in Iraq in 2002, I believe it is, and M.J. Sharp in 2017 died in the Congo. So let's look at these two individuals, their lives, and what motivated them to be willing to go into these places where there's violence to preach and teach the name of Jesus. So we've got to jump ahead here. So we're going to start with Tom Fox. And then to understand Tom Fox's role, we have to go back a few more years, all the way back to 1984. Anybody remember 1984? Yeah. 1984, the Mennonite World Conference was held in France. And the event that took place there that was really a precipitating event for Tom Fox's life and ministry was the guy by the name of Ron Sider gave a huge speech. Ron Sider, you've heard of Ron Sider maybe. Ron Sider, he wrote the book Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. He just recently passed away. Influential guy in the Anabaptist tradition. So Ron Sider stands up and he's addressing the entire delegation of World Conference for the Mennonite World Conference in France. And this is what Ron Sider had to say that day. It got a lot of people's attention. He challenged these Mennonites and Anabaptists. He said, unless we are ready to start to die by the thousands in dramatic, vigorous new exploits for peace and justice, we should sadly confess that we never really meant what we said. And we dare never whisper another word about pacifism to our sisters and brothers in those desperate lands filled with injustice. Unless we are ready to die developing new nonviolent attempts to reduce conflict, we should confess that we never really meant that the cross was an alternative to the sword. So out of this, a group known as Christian Peacemaker Teams was begun. And within a couple of years, this team started sending delegations to places like Haiti and the West Bank, working for peace and justice. A group was sent to Iraq in 2002, off a decade, 2002, to start witnessing to the injustices that were taking place there. Who was in charge of Iraq in 2002? You got it, Saddam Hussein. Hussein was known for his human rights violations. He would torture his own people. He would use chemical warfare against his own people. He committed genocide against his own people, ethnic cleansing. If you go to Harrisonburg today, there is a huge population of Kurdish people. These are people that came as refugees leaving Iraq because Saddam Hussein was trying to clean like them off the face of the earth. So Christian Peacemaker Teams comes to Iraq in 2002, and their main job there is to simply report on the injustices that they are seeing. You remember, this is the time when the internet was getting big, things were blowing up. Everybody had a blog. Everybody but Cadron had a blog. And you can publish things and everybody could read it. So this is a way of exposing the injustices that were taking place there. Whenever they saw something, they wrote it up, they made it public, and it was a way to try to keep Saddam Hussein and his people in check, to keep them accountable. All right, so then in 2005, there was a group of four people that went with Christian peacemaker teams to Iraq. There were two Canadians, one person from London, and one person from Clearwater, Virginia, which is near Winchester. That man's name was Tom Fox. He was a Quaker, and he was the youth leader in his church. In November of that year, November 26th, they were scheduled to meet with the clerics from the Muslim mosque there in Iraq. And as they were standing in a public place, ready to meet with those clerics, a van pulls up, grabs the four team members, and abducts them. This group called themselves the Sword of Righteous Brigade. Sword of Righteousness Brigade. And they started publishing videos of these hostages and saying if that USA did not release Iraqi prisoners, that these hostages would be killed. Well, about once a month or so, these videos would come out and they would show the different peacemaker team members there. And then one time they realized Tom Fox wasn't in one of the videos. They had been held in captivity for a little more than 3 months, about 3.5 months. And then on March 10th, 2006, Tom Fox's body was found in a garbage dump in Baghdad. So you can imagine that after Tom Fox's body was found, that there was a lot of pushback, a lot of attention from the United States media. Everybody's got an idea what they should do about this. And Christian Peacemaker Team put forth a statement, and they quoted Tom Fox, something that he had said before. And this is how Tom Fox's memory lives on today. Tom Fox said, "We forgive those who consider us their enemies." Let that hang in the air just a little bit. We forgive those who consider us to be enemies. Not that they're my enemies, but the people that consider us enemies. So we sit with that one a little bit, and we move to the story of M.J. Sharp. M.J., Michael Sharp, I said Michael Sharp the other day, and Heavy's like, oh, yeah, he used to go to church here. Different Michael Sharp, not the guy that helped start Sharp Shopper. This is Michael Sharp, 34 years old when he died. So I mentioned that Michael, his father John, is a cousin to Marlene. And as I'm doing my research, I chose to use this picture because I'm looking at a story in the Anabaptist world. And this is the picture that they published of M.J. Sharp, and I look at the photo credit for this picture. And I'll say a name, and it's not going to mean anything to anybody here except for one person. Photo credit was given to Amy Sharp. So Sonia's cousin took that picture. Told you, it gets a little personal here, doesn't it? So it's like, how weird is that? Like, so Sonia's cousin married into the Sharp family, and when MJ's sister got married, Amy was the photographer for the wedding service. Anyway, M.J. Sharp, interesting guy. So he educated at Eastern Mennonite University, just up the road. He graduated the year before I got to the university. I never had a chance to meet him myself. But after he graduated, he went to work with Mennonite Mission Network in Germany. And after that, he signed up to work with Mennonite Central Committee, MCC, in the Congo. So the Congo at the time, and to this day, there have been about 20 years of this violent guerrilla kind of warfare, especially along the border between the Congo and Rwanda. You've heard about like the genocides in Rwanda still going on to this day. A lot of tribal kind of violence going on. So MJ's job was to go into the Congo and engage people in conversation, to learn about their struggles, to try to convince people to lay down their guns and go back home. And there's actually stories that were published in like reputable documents, like the New York Times had a story about how MJ used to sit under the banana trees with warlords and have conversations, you know, like you do, right? What did you do today? Like, I sat around and talked about nonviolent strategies with warlord today. Had some bananas. Like, that's great. And according to MJ, about 1,600 of those guerrilla warfare members did lay down their guns and went back to be with their family. MJ's time with MCC, eventually the funding ran out, and he was hired by the United Nations. And the United Nations sent MJ, along with another person, into the Congo to continue to do the work. And about 2 weeks before MJ was going to return home to finish his time with the United Nations, he and his co-worker, I don't know how to say her name, Zadai Catalan, she was from Sweden, were abducted and then later found shot in the head. So 1 year after this took place, on March 13th of 2017, MJ's parents were interviewed for an article in the Anabaptist World, it's now called the Anabaptist World magazine. These are the words of John Sharp. John said, "Our well-being is not tied to the investigation. We have been given a gift of 500 years of peacemaking tradition. We have not called for revenge, but want to break the cycle of violence with something more restorative that will make peace for the Congolese people. Forgiveness is the only way." Sounds really familiar, doesn't it? It seems consistent. We have these stories from MJ Sharp and his father, John. We have the story from Tom Fox, this common theme of peace and forgiveness being tied hand in hand. So we want to hold those two stories and let that sit a little bit. And again, I realize this is really heavy stuff, and we're going to have to find some happy martyr stories eventually. It doesn't exist. But what I realize as I read through this is that these guys took seriously the charge that Will Willimon and Stanley Hauerwas and Ron Sider made to go into places to be peacemakers in situations where your very existence may be in jeopardy. And I think of this passage from Matthew 16, verses 24 through 25. "Whoever wants to be my disciple," this is Jesus talking, "whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it." All right, so that's the heavy stuff for today. Let's look at our scripture for this morning. This probably hasn't been like too new to many of you. If you've been around for a while, you know that Jesus says a lot about being a peacemaker, and especially we find this stuff in the Gospel of Matthew. And here's just a little bit of what Marlene read for us earlier. I have a couple of things highlighted here because it's a little bit weird to me, to be honest. And in our 21st century context, we're so removed from the world of Jesus that I think we need a little bit more understanding to get just what he's getting at here. And I've preached on this before, but I think it's so good that it's important to remind you of this every now and then. I'm drawing from the work of Walter Wink a bit here. So notice that there's some things going on, and I'm going to need a volunteer for a little bit of this. Sarah Dell, all right, would you be able to come up here? If Mom and Dad don't mind. All right. So one of the first things that I noticed, right here, is that Jesus specifically says to turn, if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, to turn the other cheek, right? So why does he specify the right cheek? Think about it like this. How many people are left-handed? We got two, three. We got that many lefties in this group? Okay, so I saw like four hands go up. So like a tenth of this group is left-handed. Maybe that's close to average. What do you think? You're right-handed, right? Because if you're not, I'm going to have to point turn off. Okay, you're right-handed. What hand is a right-handed person going to hit with? They're going to hit with your right. Right? So if you were going to slap me, it says first, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, do you know which cheek is my right cheek? It's this one because it's opposite for you. All right, so if you were going to slap me with your right hand on my right cheek, how would you do that? Use your right hand. Okay, use your that hand. How would you slap me on the right cheek, real gentle?
The only way I could do that would be this.
Something like that. It's awkward. How about like this? Backhand me. Okay, so a right-handed person strikes a person on the right cheek with a backhand. And that is the hand of a superior slapping an inferior person. A master might slap their slave with the backhand. Now it says, if a person strikes you on the right cheek, you are to turn them the other cheek. And it's not like, please, can I have another, you know? It's my British accent, sorry. I know right from left, so take that. If I offer you my other cheek, now what are you going to do? Yeah, you can really get into it and slap me with an open hand. All right, thank you, Sarah Dell. You can head back. Thank you. Everybody give Sarah Dell a round of applause. What Jesus is saying is if somebody strikes you on the right cheek with the right hand, that's going to be a backhanded slap. That's a sign of inferiority of the person who is being slapped. Jesus is essentially saying, you can tell this person, hey, if you're going to slap me, you're at least going to treat me as an equal, because a person of equal status would slap you on the right cheek, or the left cheek with the right hand. Okay, makes sense, right? And how about this next one? If anybody wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. In Jesus' day, it was common to wear two pieces